God, what a way to end an album. I was thinking about the other day, I'm thinking, wow, she ends album one with The Kick Inside, album two with Hammer Horror, album three with this, album four with Get Out of My House. All four of those songs are like in my top 10 of her songs. Like, I mean, The Morning Fog is a satisfying ending to Hounds of Love, and I know people really love it, but it's more satisfying because it completes the story. It's not like, like those other four album enders are the type of songs where I hear them and I'm like, I feel like I was just kind of like sucked into this vortex and spat out and need to process. Like,
seriously,
this is how you end this is how you end an album.
I think there are a few points in Kate Bush's career where like she crafts one song that's just musically, lyrically, thematically just ahead of everything she's done before. Like, say, earlier examples would be Wuthering Heights or The Kick Inside. I think this is one of those instances. Like, after this, I'd say maybe Night of the Swallow or Jig of Life. Or even Running Up That Hill. But yeah, this is like probably a top two Kate Bush songs for me, and that it's just it's odd because her songs are so full of optimism, because like I say, there's a central theme to her work. It's kind of the inherent magic of the universe, and it's not something she abandons here, but like say this whole mystical spiritual thing, it's a song where like she sounds like she's given up.
Welcome to Strange Phenomena, Music of Kate Bush. I am Cecily Link, and this week we're going to be talking about the last track on Never Forever, Breathing.
Outside gets inside, ooh, through her skin.
With me to talk about the song this week, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Chris. I write the Kate Bush blog, Dream of Organon, which you can find at katebushsongs.wordpress.com. And basically there, I just roughly, chronologically, I go through every song in Kate Bush's discography, officially released or bootlegged, and just try to just tell the story of Kate Bush in chronological order.
I'm Zoe. I spoke about a bunch of other songs on this album and Lionheart. And Breathing is in my top three Kate Bush songs of all time. Also just one of my favorite songs of all time, period. So I'm really excited to talk about it. And God, what a way to end an album. I was thinking about the other day, I'm thinking, wow, she ends album one with The Kick Inside, album two with Hammer Horror, album three with this, album four with Get Out of My House. All four of those songs are like in my top 10. Of her songs. Like, I mean, The Morning Fog is a satisfying ending to Hounds of Love, and I know people really love it, but it's more satisfying because it completes the story. It's not like those other four album enders are the type of songs where I hear them and I'm like, I feel like I was just kind of like sucked into this vortex and spat out and needed to process. Like,
seriously,
this is how you end an album.
So you had said, when we were kind of first connected on Twitter and everything, you had said right off the bat that you wanted to talk about Breathing.
Oh, yeah.
So what is it about Breathing that makes it one of your absolute favorite Kate Bush songs? And feel free to ramble, because I love like letting people ramble and talk about why these songs are so important to them. And I know you've got a lot of thoughts on this song.
Well, it's about the end of the world, which is always pleasant, but...
Oh, seriously, yes. Always. Nice, happy subject!
It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine, to quote Ariane. But
I've got that song in my head now.
I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself, Churn. But yeah, it's I guess I'll like say I've always been a fan of fantasy and science fiction. So like the world ending is it's very much a concept that I'm comfortable with exploring, and looking outside every day and looking at the news, it like often does feel like I'm facing the apocalypse. So like I listen to songs like this and I'm like, yeah, that's about right. The thing is that she takes a very she takes the absolute possibly the weirdest angle to the apocalypse ever, which is saying a lot, and that is detailing nuclear fallout through the point of view of a fetus.
Well, it may be the last song on the album, but it was actually the lead single released on April 14th, 1980. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, again, it's interesting because with Hammer Horror, that was the last song in Lionheart, and she released it as the first single, and she did it again here. And it's very unusual for artists to do that, and especially considering this song. I mean, I gather my hypothesis about why she would have made it lead singles because she was so proud of it. You'll talk about later when you quote her. She says mm-hmm. she thinks they're best things she'd written to that point. But I mean, I think it's her strangest song up to that point. Mm-hmm. So probably the least obvious as lead single. I mean, when you have Babushka right there.
Seriously.
All power to her.
But it did really well as a single, unlike Hammer Horror, which was the lead single. For Lionheart, this one went to number 16 on the UK charts, and number 44 in the Netherlands, and number 25 in Belgium, and remained on the UK charts for 7 weeks. So almost
That's
2 months.
Surprising.
Very surprising.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing pop about it at all.
No.
Whereas Hammer Horror is more poppy, so. But I don't say that as a bad thing. It's a masterpiece.
I mean, I guess people were in the mood for Kate Bush and then would just kind of accept anything that she that she released. But I don't know. I guess everybody, they say 1980, it's very, year full of turmoil. So they thought, why not just listen to the fetus singing about nuclear war? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying fetus because of her voice. I mean, just fetus because of the subject matter.
Well, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, like what's more amazing to me is that like it was successful, like reached number 16 on the charts and stayed there for 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm. When let's see what all was going on around there at the time, we had on the charts there was Michael Jackson, Paul McCartney, The Undertones, Motorhead, Blondie with Call Me, The Average White Band. And along comes Breathing.
And it just I mean, I'm glad that there's a point where Kate Bush and Blondie were both charting, but
in the top 20, yes. At least in Britain they were.
And the Undertones in there too, that's something.
Oh, and then at number 23 we had Theme from MASH, Suicide is Painless.
I mean, isn't that just a Never Forever song?
No, not really.
Okay.
Although it could be. But I mean, yeah, this reached number 16. It went to number 44 in the Netherlands. It went to number 25 in Belgium. And like you said, it was on the charts for 7 weeks.
That's, I mean, imagine just walking into, say, a coffee shop and hearing this song.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't happen now, that's for sure.
At 8 in the morning, just like you're barely awake, haven't had your coffee yet, and you hear someone sing about nuclear war. It's like, no, stop, I haven't had my coffee yet. What are you doing?
Yeah, this one is, like, I agree with you that it is probably her strangest song up to this point, even stranger than Wuthering Heights, because this one...
Structurally,
this is prog rock.
Right.
I can
like
tell...
Wuthering Heights has a chorus. I mean, so does Breathing, but it's different.
Mm-hmm. But each time she does the chorus, either something drops away or something comes mm-hmm. in. Like, and there's movements to it. Like, it starts in one place and then kind of twists and goes to something else, and then it goes into the chorus.
Absolutely.
and then we get
it's
to the ending.
Oh yeah. I mean, what I love, what makes this song so special for me is that it's its own little universe. I mean, even though it's the way you're talking at it now, it's a self-contained little world in a song. And she does that with a lot. I mean, most of her songs are their own self-contained little stories, but this to me is more than a self-contained story. It's a self-contained world, not just in the story. Because to be honest, like the story, the lyrics actually, the story itself that it tells isn't even that compelling to me. It's more of the production and the way she tells it, the vocals, the production, and everything about how it's done that make it so mind. I just think this is such a staggering piece of art. It's definitely not for everyone. It's definitely the kind of thing, because it's very proggy, people will call it self-indulgent or call it pretentious or like, you know, but it's, I mean, you can hear it in my voice. Even thinking about it, I'm completely floored. And I've listened to this song hundreds of times over years, but every time I hear it, it's just like, I feel like it's just got like gobsmacked. It's just such a masterpiece. She really did that.
I find it very interesting that this was released as the lead single for the album. So what do you think of the fact that this song, which we were talking about, it's got movement to it, it's got an unorthodox structure, it's about the theme alone is not your typical like sitting around committee kind of song, is a lead single for an album. What do you think of that?
It's very Kate Bush.
Indeed. Trying to look and see the week that it peaked. Yeah, the week it peaked was May 18th, 1980. So a month after this single was released, it peaked at number 16. It also was the first single to feature a non-LP track because it had the empty bowl ring.
You know, it's funny you mentioned like the sudden May 18th was when it peaked.
Yep, that's according to officialcharts.com.
That's the day that Mount St. Helens erupted.
I wonder if there's a connection.
it's Kate Bush's fault. Kate Bush caused Mount St. Helens to erupt with her song about nuclear war.
I guess she did. Dang it, girl. Boy, you were just even cooler than I thought you were. Anyway.
So I was listening to it again today, and
me too.
I was thinking, like, would this song, what would it make any sense if you didn't know the backstory? Because I'm trying to think that when I first listened, I first listened to all her albums in chronological order, so I don't think I knew the backstory. But I then researched everything, you know. So I'm not sure. Like, I know that when I first listened to all her work, like The Dreaming really stood out for me, that album. So I can't remember if this wasn't like my favorite initially. Like my favorite is Night of the Swallow and then Get Out of My House and this. Those are three songs that I think completely create their own little world. I think because the production and the vocals are just so interesting, you don't even need to know what it's about to appreciate it. But it is about a very specific story, which I'll explain.
The story of this song is you got a fetus, quote, very much aware of what is going on outside the womb and frightened by nuclear fallout, which implies the song is set either during a nuclear war or post-apocalyptic birth. The lyrics
which
also refer to the fetus absorbing nicotine from the mother smoking, because, hey, this is late 70s. Everybody smoked.
There were a lot of things going on in the world that people were concerned about, but this isn't like, you know, like my dad growing up. He grew up in like my parents growing up in the 50s that they hide under the desk, you know? Mm-hmm. That nuclear war wasn't like the top priority at the time.
Well, apparently the inspiration for her writing a song about nuclear fallout was from a documentary that Kate had seen about the effects of nuclear war. And while, quote, the tone of the song was inspired by Pink Floyd's The Wall, which I can
definitely
hear. Hence the prog rock thing.
But this is definitely Pink Floyd-y, for sure. It's interesting because she said that Wow was inspired by
I was about
Floyd,
to say,
the spacey sound. But this, I hear it even more, especially in terms of, I mean, The Wall is a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, it's just like nuclear, it's not like she was growing up during the Cuban Missile Crisis where like everyone was obsessed with nuclear warfare. So it's interesting that that's what kind of was at the forefront of her mind.
Yep, and it was recorded over 3 days in the early part of 1980. And they decided to make it the final track on the album. Also, this track includes spoken words that, honestly, I didn't even know were supposed to be full sentences until I looked it up for this episode.
Mm-hmm.
The exact words which are missing from the artwork on the album are, in point of fact, it is possible to tell the difference between a small nuclear explosion and a large one by a very simple method. The calling card of a nuclear bomb is the blinding flash that is far more dazzling than any light on Earth, brighter even than the sun itself, and it is by the duration of this flash that we are able to determine the size of the weapon. After the flash, a fireball can be seen to rise, sucking up under it the debris, dust, and living things around the area of the explosion, and as this ascends, it soon becomes recognizable as the familiar mushroom cloud. As a demonstration of the flash duration test, let's try and count the number of seconds for the flash emitted by a very small bomb, then a more substantial medium-sized bomb, and finally one of our very powerful high-yield bombs.
So basically what this song is about, it's from the point of view of a fetus of a pregnant woman, and the fetus is, I guess she must be, I don't know, maybe she's pro-life, we'll see, I don't know, but the fetus is very aware of the fetus, it's the fetus basically I can't breathe because all this shit is,
mm-hmm.
like, because nuclear war is happening, and it's, to me, what makes the song really powerful, and I'm very pro-choice, but anyways, what makes it very powerful is, it's kind of a cry, it's about resilience and mm-hmm. about life and the human will to survive even before it is a human.
I think there are a few points in Kate Bush's career where like she crafts one song that's just musically, lyrically, thematically, just ahead of everything she's done before. Like say, earlier examples would be Wuthering Heights or The Kick Inside. And let's see. I think this is one of those instances. Like after this, I'd say maybe Night of the Swallow or Jig of Life, but or even Running Up That Hill. But yeah, this is like probably a top two Kate Bush songs for me. In that it's just it's odd because it's like it's a song. Her songs are so full of optimism because like I say, there's a central theme to her work. It's kind of the inherent magic of the universe and. It's not something she abandons here, but like say this whole mystical spiritual thing. It's a song where she sounds like she's given up. Like say the protagonist, there's no escape from it this time. Because say Kate Bush, she's very much into the agency of the body, and that like even here it's getting within. Like my radar sends me send me danger, but my instincts tell me to keep breathing.
Mm-hmm.
The body just slowly being poisoned. It's just this I mean, it's very, very incredibly haunting. I mean, not just the lyrical content, but just like the sound. Like, it does not sound like anything else she makes. I mean, you get, like, say, you get to the more schizoid sounds of the dreaming through this, but even the dreaming doesn't sound like the sound like breathing.
I mean, you can see where she starts to go into the dreaming, because it is, the song doesn't feel like your usual sort of pop song where they're repeating the same four chords throughout the whole thing. Like, this has movements to it. Definitely, like, I mean, she even says that this is like her little symphony, and I can totally see that.
Yeah, even rhythmically, it's kind of organic and breathing, isn't it? Like, say, like, you have a one measure, 4-4, then 3-4, then 4-4, then 2-4. Like, I haven't looked in the sheet music in over a year, but yeah,
We're breaking out the sheet music.
Thank you for explaining why I shouted.
So, yeah, the song starts out, just for outside gets inside, it's 2-4 to 4-4, then 2-4, then to 3-4 for inside, or through her, and then for skin it goes to 2-4, and then I've been out before, but this time it's much safer in, is going back to 4-4, so yeah, it's constantly shifting.
Yeah.
With the time signatures.
Yeah, sort of organic, you know, it's like it does, like, almost sound like a human being breathing.
And it didn't even really hit me until I was listening to this song before we started recording and watching the video, which we'll get to later in the episode. But at the very end with the backing vocals, that they're saying, "We are all gonna die."
Yeah. Dark stuff. Well, and we'll get to it more when we dig into the actual structure of the song, lyrics, but, like, what works so, like, just having a song where you're saying, "We're all going to die," it's like, okay, Morrissey, we know. But, like, but it's not, like, it doesn't, when you read the lyrics and listen to the song, it's completely different. So the way that's structured is, I mean, we'll get more into this, but the second part of the song is a call and response structure. So you have these male voices saying, like, "We're all going to die," then instead, and she is the fetus saying, "Let me breathe." So it's kind of just that, like, the voices, they're saying, "We're going to die," all the dark stuff. That's what's coming out from outside to inside, as she puts it. And then her desperation to survive and move past it is what's breaking through, both vocally and sonically. So it's really this, the fascinating call and response structure, where it's not as opposed to like some emo song saying, "Hey, we're all gonna die, we're fucked."
Yeah, I mean, with the production, she's got a Prophet synthesizer on there. She's got electric guitar from Alan Murphy of Smurf playing his guitar refrain. Brian Beth. She's got Max Middleton.
What is a Prophet synthesizer? Does it mean it's Jesus?
Jesus synthesizer. No, it is the Prophet 5 is an analog synthesizer manufactured by Sequential Circuits between 1978 and 1984 with the five voices of polyphony. The Prophet 5 is the first fully programmable polyphonic synthesizer. So it's a particular kind of synthesizer that you could actually program with other sounds. Not quite
so kind of like a Fairlight.
Not quite a Fairlight, but the same kind of idea that you could fully program it. And also it had an embedded microprocessor. So This thing cost a lot of money back then and everything, but it's a particular type of synthesizer. So.
Yeah, because there are sounds in this song that where I hear them, I'm like, what instrument made that sound? For example, towards the end, there's a sound where it sounds like you're being sucked into a vortex. I'm like, what instrument made that? So that's good to know. And yeah, backing vocals by Roy Harper. That's interesting because he's a folk singer that she was a fan of, and she covered one of his songs once and did some backing vocals for him. Now he's doing Vice Versa.
Yep. And her drums by Stuart Elliott, who'd played with her before. There's John Giblin on the fretless bass. Fender Rhodes, got a little electric piano there, by Max Middleton. I especially hear the Fender Rhodes in the chorus, like when she, right after she sings Breathing, and you can hear like a ba 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 kind of thing, or during like the out, out, out.
Right.
And right before it gets into the, like, the John, we are all going to die. There's like a ba 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 ba. Yeah, that's a Fender Rhodes. That's an electric piano there. I love electric piano. They don't use electric piano much in music anymore.
Yeah, and that's one of the things where I was wondering, I was like, what instrument is making? Because I don't know a lot about music. So I was thinking, like, what instrument is making that noise? That's good to know.
Which is interesting, since that there's an electric piano on this song. And then when we get to talking about the one-off performance of Kate doing this song for Comic Relief in 1986, she was playing on an electric piano. I haven't looked at the video to see if, when she's accompanying herself on an electric piano. And
it sounds like a normal, I always assumed it was just a regular piano.
No, it's an electric piano. I'll have to look at the video to see what kind it is, like if it's even visible, really, because it's kind of an older video, but.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of different things going on in the production in this song, like, for sure. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Which is just neat that she eventually did that live version for Comic Relief in 1986, where it was just her and an electric piano, nobody else behind her. So she took this song that was so produced and then put it back to just, me playing it on the piano, like she probably did for these musicians before they went and added stuff. Was just, it's just, well, we'll get into that part when we get to it. Anyway, cross that bridge when we get there.
Like through the Kate Bush Encyclopedia page, and like she talked about this song a lot.
Yeah, I pulled out a lot of quotes for her, and I mean I can tell just like the sheer amount of notes for her talking about the song that obviously this was something she was really proud of. This, pardon the pun, considering the song, this was her baby.
Oh.
Like, this was her, she recorded this over 3 days,
days
in 1980, and I know in Under the Ivy, there was a lot of talk about how she had talked with the musicians, like, trying to get them to, rather than just rote play the notes, that she wanted a lot of emotion in them, which was something that was difficult for her to try and convey to them, because these were session musicians, like, okay, it says we're supposed to play a C chord, okay. Hey, here, we play a C chord.
But, like, C, but play it in C flat sharp.
Or play it like you're about to cry or something like that.
Like this, but in the key of Q. But yeah, like, apparently that song was just, like, absolutely hell to get right. Like, it just, like, she really struggled over those few days. But, I mean, but I'd rather much hear a song she struggled with than something she just settled for.
Exactly. And I can understand why she pushed the way she did for the song, because it should feel like a very breathing human song.
Yeah.
Since it is considering the subject matter.
Yeah, it's like a song that keeps moving too, like, say, it's probably closest to the demo, which we don't have, obviously. But it starts out, like, say, it's just the piano, and then, like, slowly bringing in other instruments.
And even like, but the other instruments, I mean, there's the drum, there's drums from Stuart Elliott, who, you know, he popped up on all of her first two, three albums. Some fretless bass. She got some Fender Rhodes. She got Brian Bath and Alan Murphy playing electric guitar. A Prophet synthesizer. Got some Prophet synthesizer from Larry Fast. We got some percussion from Morris Pert. And backing vocals from Roy Harper.
So she's like, this is a team of nine musicians working on this song then. So that's like a lot of people trying to get it right.
And then, of course, Kate singing and playing piano and doing the backing vocals. I love the way she does her backing vocals on this song.
Oh, yeah.
Especially after at the end of the second verse, I'm trying to pull up the lyrics, where there's like a bunch of ahs behind her. Oh, yeah. Only the fools blew it. You and me knew life itself is breathing.
Ooh.
I love the ahs back there. It's just like, oh my goodness. It just like sends shivers down your spine.
Yeah, it's this, it's cathartic. It is just, what was that lyric you said? Like, only the fools knew? Or?
Yeah, only the fools blew it. You and me knew life itself is breathing.
Well, there's another loaded lyric.
This song and Army Dreamers fit. I mean, we kind of talked about this in Army Dreamers that, you know, these two songs, Breathing and Army Dreamers, feel like they fit very well together. Even though they're so different in terms of production, because one is a waltzy, happy sounding folk sort of song, and this and is like prog rock.
Yes. Yeah, it's just this. It's a very strange song, and it is very 1979-80 in its concerns. Like, I'm trying to remember where the Cold War was in its progression at the time, but like, it was like clearly like enough where like people were still writing songs about nuclear war. Usually her folk songs tend to be more, you know, like call back to Irish English music, but this, you know, it's more like, say, 60s, you know, maybe American British folk songs, which would sing about nuclear war, like, say, well, Dylan's Masters of War, only, like, this does not identify villains as such, but, like, say, like, what's, like, only the fools blew it. So, like, there's still, like, someone is to blame there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say, what was happening in 1979?
Well, when we were going through our history, at least in our U.S. history class, we never made it up to the 80s. We were lucky to make it to the 60s, which always disappointed me, because I wanted to get up to the more modern stuff where, oh, gee, I could ask my parents what it was like to going through this in the 70s or something like that.
Yeah, I attended Catholic school, so we didn't get past the 17th century. But
oh, geez.
It was awful. It was. But yeah, it's, let's see, it's, like, so Reagan was taking over at the time, so there was obviously this big change of a foreign policy approach during the Soviet Union. So, like, there's obviously a lot of stress in the atmosphere. I mean, maybe not nuclear fallout, but stress.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my parents remember in the 60s and 70s when they were kids having bomb drills.
Oh, yeah.
You having to hide under your desk because of something, because in case something happens.
And there were those freaky PSAs, like, have you seen that famous Daisy PSA for the nuclear bombs? But yeah, so for anybody who doesn't know, it's basically this little girl walking around in a field, and she picks up this flower and, like, tearing off petals and, like, counting, like, one, two, three. And then it gets replaced by this big dramatic countdown, like, nuclear bomb goes off. And it's just this hilariously, like, fucked up little PSA. But yeah, that's the sort of world that Kate Bush had grown up in. Although I'm not sure that if the Red Scare was, say, as much a thing as in England.
Well, I know it was here. I mean, my parents remember a lot of that.
Yeah.
So. And I really like this quote from Kate. This is from the Kate Bush Club newsletter in 1980. You know, back when she used to talk extensively about her songs. I wanted to write a song, and I came up with some chords which sounded to me very dramatic. Then up popped the line.
Outside. it actually reminds me a lot of Hammer. The opening chord reminds me a lot of the opening chord of Hammer Horror. Like this tension.
Actually, let me see. I don't think they're quite in the same key. They're both of them are in a minor key for sure.
No, they're not the same, but it's just there's something about the mood where you're like all of a sudden there's a very tense mood. It's like duh, yeah.
Yeah, up popped the line, outside gets inside. As I was trying to piece the song together, and I thought it'd be good to write a song about a baby inside the womb. Then I came to a chorus piece.
I was just thinking about that, yeah.
And decided that the obvious word to go there was breathing. And I thought automatically that it had been done before. But asking around, I couldn't understand why it hadn't, because it's such a good word. Then breathing, and the baby turned into the concept of life, and the last form of life that would be around. That would be a baby that was about to be born after the blast. It was a very personal song. I thought at the time that it was self-indulgent, and it was something I just did for myself, really. For me, it's a statement that I hope won't happen.
Yeah, it's funny that the first thing she thought was outside gets inside. I think that's such a powerful opening. Outside gets inside through her skin. It's just, even if you don't know what the song is about, that just is such vivid and poetic and beautiful imagery. So it's cool that the whole song sprung from there.
I have been out before, but this time it's much safer in...
Yeah, what's up with it? So she's a reincarnated Venus. I've been out before, but this time it's been safer. And
yeah.
I've heard some people say that she's it's actually a reincarnated Venus.
Last night in the sky, such a bright light. My radar send me danger, but my instincts tell me to keep breathing.
Yeah, just and the way she sings it is is what really makes it amazing. The way she's the last night in the sky, such a bright light. The way she's such a bright light. I'm such a broken record, but I just... What I love about her, I say this all the time, what she does so well is that she's really living and breathing the song. Like when she says such a bright light, you hear the wonder in her voice of seeing that bright light. And it's like this childlike wonder. And she's always capturing the emotion in the words and not just singing the words. She's living those words. It's beautiful. It's so beautiful.
Just looking over the lyrics just in general, other than the lyric that you said you really like with the chips of plutonium, that you don't even really know if it's a nuclear blast.
Right.
I mean, last night in the sky, such a bright light. I mean, that could be, oh, hey, Halley's Comet. Hey.
Yeah, airplane, anything. I mean, I think that's why this song can... be more broad and universal. Because, for example, she's talking about breathing my mother and breathing her nicotine, breathing in fallout. I mean, look where our planet's up. Look how our planet is now. You know, I mean, it doesn't even, yes, it's about a fetus in nuclear war, but it can just be about a paranoid, like, this definitely plays in paranoia people have about, like, chemicals and all toxic stuff in the air right now. Mm-hmm. Makes you wonder if when she was, like, when she was pregnant, she was like, oh, I only have natural things when I'm pregnant or something. One of those moms.
Well, I read she gave up smoking.
Yeah, well, I would hope, but yeah.
I would hope, yes, so definitely. So that's...
And it's funny because with breathing her nicotine, I read an interview with her from this time where she actually comments in that line. She's like, oh, I know I smoke and I know it's so bad and I shouldn't do it, but I can't help it. But so she's kind of calling herself out.
Yep. See, that's just one thing that Kate said about about the song. She also called it her little symphony. Quote, because I think every writer, whether they admit it or not, loves the idea of writing their own symphony. I agree.
Yeah, then that's like what I was saying. This song feels like it contained an entire universe. It's not just a song. Like it is a complete symphony.
And I can hear in her vocal the way that, especially toward the end, when she gets, when they're doing the, we are all going to die, and she does, you know, let me breathe. She gets really raw there.
Oh, God, yeah.
And it feels like, okay, I can see, you know, it's like in hindsight, like 38 years later, where she ended up going on the dreaming because of her, like, she's allowing her voice to get even more raw than she ever has.
Yeah, and it's again where her vocal performance is in service of the emotion of the song, because it's this desperation to literally, it's life or death. Mm-hmm. And she is at the end, her voice is breaking, and because she is pleading to be allowed to live. It's literally, it's the highest stakes you can get, and the desperation in her voice reflects that, and it is, well, I was going to say breathtaking. I know if that was in the context of the song, great word. But it's really remarkable, the way her use of her voice as an instrument of to convey emotion. And this song is a really primary example of that. And even, like, yeah, it's, in hindsight, completely shows going with the dreaming. I love this song so much that I feel like, controversial statement, whatever, even if she'd, like, never made another album after this, she would be a legend anyway, just for these three albums. And also, like, ending on this note, like, I think she would have been more of a footnote in music history than she is had she not made Hounds of Love and Dreaming, mm-hmm. As opposed to, like, a really important figure. She probably would have been viewed as, like, that weird British chick who made three weird albums.
Yeah.
But she still would have been remembered. Like, this mm-hmm. is such an accomplishment. She thinks it's the best thing she'd ever written at that point, and she's very hard on herself.
That's, mm-hmm.
I wonder, and it's interesting because she did perform it again live in 1986, so she still must have had some positive regard for it, even though she usually kind of trashes all mm-hmm. her anything she's done in the past.
Yeah, she says, she also says, I find this interesting too, the song says something real for me, whereas many of the others haven't quite got to the level that I would like them to reach, though they're trying to. Often it's because the song won't allow it, and that song has allowed everything that I wanted to be done to it. That track was easy to build up. Although it had to be huge, it was just speaking, saying what had to be put on it. In many ways, I think the most exciting thing was making the backing track. The session men had their lines, they understood what the song was about, but at first there was no emotion, and that track was demanding so much emotion. It wasn't until they actually played with feeling that the whole thing took off. When we went and listened, I wanted to cry because of what they had put into it. It was so tender.
Aww.
It meant a lot to me that they had put in as much as they could, because it must get hard for session guys. Oh, I'm sure. They get paid by the hour, and so many people don't want to hear the emotion. They want clear, perfect tuning, a good sound. But often the out-of-tuneness, the uncleanliness, doesn't matter as much as the emotional content that's in there. I think that's much more important than the technicalities. That was from Fire in the Bush, from Zigzag Magazine, 1980.
Fire in the Bush. That's not a good article title.
No, it's not.
But yeah, no, I think that's what makes the song really powerful, that it's about more than just, like, technical perfection. It's about this wild, it ends up like, even in the beginning when she's saying, I've been out before, well, the way she does this thing where she stresses certain syllables in a way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've been out before, but this time it's
much,
you
know, safer. Like, it's,
so she does it in this way where there's just this pleading desperation and there's so much emotion, and she's right that, and it's what I said earlier, that to me a good vocalist isn't mm-hmm. the most technically perfect vocalist, but the one who you believe what they're saying the most.
And you can tell on this song that she definitely believes everything that she's saying. I mean, she always does, she really does, but
yeah, she has to. I mean, it's like the characters and the narrators of all of her songs possess her whenever she sings it. It really is. She says, I suddenly realized the whole devastation and disgusting arrogance of it all, trying to destroy something that we've not created, the earth. The only thing we are is a breathing mechanism. Everything is breathing. Without it, we're just nothing. And so, again, even though that's this song about nuclear war, that still is completely relevant today. I mean, our world is in even worse shape today than it was in 1980.
I try not to think about the fact that we might just be very close to a nuclear war with North Korea. Yay. Woo-hoo.
Yeah, no, that's, Well, no, I mean, that's what's interesting is, like, that wasn't really at the forefront of people's thoughts in 1980, but, like, now it very much is.
Very relevant.
Yeah. I mean, this is believable. I have friends who have said, I don't want to have children because I don't think this world is going to be a bit of, like, a place that would be a good place to be living. You know, they don't want their baby. They don't want their infants to feel like the fetus and breathing. And she says that she also calls it, she says, it's a fetus, but it's more of a spiritual being. It has all the senses, sight, smell, touch, taste, and hearing. And it knows what's going on outside the mother's womb. Yet it wants desperately to carry on living, as we all do, of course. And yeah, as I said, I think it's the song is about the will to live. Nuclear fallout is something we're all aware of and worried about happening in our lives. There's so much I love in this song. So what, let's see, favorite moments.
Yeah,
the urgency in her voice, and she says, I've been out before, but this time it's much safer in. This is the way she stresses certain syllables. She's so committed that you fully believe every word of what she's saying.
I've been out before, but this time it's much safer in.
And another moment I really love, then underneath, as she says, last night, her British accent is especially strong in this song, of all of them, like very strong. But there's last night, the drum beat underneath. Wow, that moment really blows me away. That is one of my favorite moments of production in all of her work. It's so ominous, and it's also a little nice connection to the song that preceded it, Army Dreamers, of this like military kind of drum beat thing. But that little drum beat underneath is just so ominous and foreboding. It's just absolutely perfect. It's one of the things that makes the song perfect to me. And then, yeah, I just had a British accent really strong in the song I love, and she says, we've lost our chance. We're the first and last. It's great, you know?
We've lost our chance. We're the first and last.
So that's another, and as I said earlier, call and response format is just genius, because on its own saying, we are all going to die, as I said, like, that's just, okay, like, that's just some mid-2000s emo song, but formatted as a call and response with her basically screaming about saying, let me breathe, works brilliantly as a juxtaposition between impending doom and the human will to survive and perseverance in the face of doom. And that's ultimately what this song, I think, is about.
Oh, so what do you think of the only time that Kate Bush has ever performed this song live?
I think it's one of her best live performances. Like say it's so sort of, I don't want to compare Kate Bush and Tori Amos too much, because I think that's a reductive approach that's unfair to both of them. But I think
Thank you.
Yeah, like, it is mostly just, you know, it's like, oh, hey, here are two women artists. I know we have to compare them in every single aspect, but, like, I think, in this case, I think it is very much, she's doing that sort of Tori Amos thing where she'll take, you know, what's in the studio has, like, a ton of instruments and just pare it down to a piano song, but, like, just in a way that really works. Yeah, like, that's a gorgeous performance, though. It's just, like, she performed that at the Secret Policeman's Ball, right?
It was a comic relief concert.
Oh, that was close. But, yeah, that's not a comic relief song.
No, it's not.
It's no Do Bears.
Oh, goodness. It'll be interesting when I get to that one.
Yes. One of the first things that hit me when I started writing the blog is, like, I'm going to have to write about that song someday.
You know, she didn't write it, but she performed it. Like, I'm going to have to talk about Rocket Man when I get to that one.
I'm so sorry.
See, I actually really like her version of Rocket Man. I mean, she makes it her own, and I'm so glad it's not a karaoke type version.
I mean, yeah, that's a relief. It's very much Kate Bush's Rocket Man. Like, it's not, she's not just trying to sound like Elton John. I mean, you have all her early demos to sound like Elton John, but...
I mean, what I think is really striking about Kate performing this just girl in electric piano style is that even with it, just her voice and piano, it's still a beautiful song. Mm-hmm. And it's still haunting, especially at the end where she's singing, you know, quick, breathe in deep.
Oh, yeah.
And that she's still got a little bit of the upper range for doing, you know, leave us or give us something to breathe.
Yeah, she's still moving around. Like, there's a thing, and like, even you take away this with the effects, I mean, they elevate, you know, with it's just this melodically great song. It's a, like, I mean, like, something like minimal vocally. I mean, even though she's taking it down a notch for that performance, she's still, you know, moving constantly. Like she doesn't lose any urgency there.
It's interesting also, like, to, like you were talking about, that she took the song that was very produced and pared it down to probably just how she wrote the song.
Yeah.
Originally. And I like hearing that she just took it. And God, it really makes me wish that she would have done this kind of thing more.
Yes. Like, I mean, just like, and again, it's sort of bring it back to Tori, but like, just do the Tori Amos thing. Just take your piano around the world, play 120 shows a year. Okay, maybe not. But yeah, just the Kate Bush Unplugged. Just give us the Kate Bush Unplugged album.
Exactly. Have that replace Director's Cut.
Oh, I have still not listened to that album, and I'm not really in a hurry to hear it before I have to write about it.
There was only ever one live performance of this song, and it was in 1986. It was on April 25th, 1986, at the Shaftesbury Theatre in London's West End. It was a solo version, Kate singing this and accompanying herself on an electric piano, doing this for a comic relief show. And why she chose this song, who knows?
I think it makes sense, because, like, thinking about, like, not-for-profit charity thing, it's kind of political-type song.
True. But either way, I'm glad that at least there is a version of her singing this live, since we've gotten up to the point of her career where Kate really doesn't do, like, singing live stuff anymore, which is such a shame.
And it's especially great to hear this live, because this is a song, like pretty much everything on The Dreaming, that you would almost think is unperformable. So it's all about the production.
Oh, yeah.
And then you hear her play on the piano, you're like, oh, you can actually perform this. Okay. I just would never think of this as, like you said, it kind of is a strange choice for forms. It's so production heavy, but when you strip it down, it still works. I mean, it doesn't work as well. You said you like it better. It doesn't work nearly as well for me, but.
Well, it depends on my mood.
But it's interesting that it's. Yeah.
Because sometimes if I'm in the mood, like if I'm just in like a chill sort of Kate mood, like I want to listen to just her playing piano or playing something and singing, then I turn to this one. But I do like the more produced version and its various movements, that you've got all these other instruments kind of coming in and out. In and out.
Yeah.
Like breathing.
I feel like even if you're feeling chill, the live version is very not chill. Because like, I really, in the live version, my favorite moment is when she goes, when she says quick, breathe in deep, she says it with a lot of urgency. It's really moving. So it's still, I think, because of the subject matter, and she still is singing with a lot of urgency, and it's very, with the opening chord, it's so tense. It's done outside, you know? It's such a tense opening chord. I'm like, it's not going to be chill. Whereas, like, I can put on her demos and, like, feel pretty chill.
I'm glad it exists. I'm glad somebody recorded this thing.
And I'm glad they recorded it on video.
And yeah, and they got it on video too. Like, oh, I wish that somebody had done that for Blow Away.
I know.
Didn't somebody pull like this shit? Come on.
I know, or even record it all. But I really like watching live. Well, she's wearing the world's ugliest outfit. But it's 1986.
Yes,
so
it was 1986.
So it turns the world others out. It's just like, it basically is like, it's like, you know, Talking Heads, Not Making Sense. It kind of looks like that type of suit thing. But the bright mustard yellow. But anyway, but she looks gorgeous. She's sitting at the piano and playing it. And then I just really love, like, you just don't, I just love this one, this video of it, which is on YouTube. If you look at Breathing Live, Kate Bush.
Yep.
I love that because you don't get to see her perform live, you know? It's something we don't see. So it's really great. And there's a moment at the, right when she finishes, she's really cute. She smiles. Like, it's kind of like a little, like, she, throughout, and even before the dawn, like, after every song, she says, thank you, thank you. She's aware of performing and aware of her audience and grateful for her audience in a way that I find very moving and humble. Like, most people aren't going to, like, smile and say thank you after performing and after getting applause, most rock stars, you know? But she does, and this smile, and she has this thing where when she smiles, she has a dimple in her cheek. It's really cute. Yeah, I really like that moment because it's like she just performed this really intense song, and then she's doing a cute little smile.
Skin. I've been out before, but this time it's much safer in. Last night in the sky, such a bright light. My radar sent me danger, but my instincts tell me to keep breathing. Breathing, breathing my mother in, breathing my beloved in, breathing, breathing her nicotine, breathing, breathing the fall out in, out in, out in. We've lost our charm. We're the first and the last, ooh. After the blast, chips of plutonium are twinkling in every lung. I love my beloved, ooh. All and everywhere, only the fools blow it, you and me.
To me, listening to this song is a sad reminder of the fact that Kate does not tour. Because one of my favorite things is going to hear a favorite artist live and having them switch up a song. Like, they'll add an extra verse, or they'll take away something, or they'll extend something. And we don't get that with Kate. We don't have tons of live versions to pour through, which, I mean, is good for me making this podcast. I don't have like 50,000 versions of Breathing to go through. But at the same time, it's a testament to how well structured this song and most of her songs are, that she can take away the production and just play it girl and piano style and it still sounds fucking beautiful. I mean,
well, I always wonder, so no song from The Dreaming has ever been performed live.
Mm-mm.
I'm still alive after saying that. I did not break down.
No,
but anyway.
I actually did have that thought the other day that, oh, wait a minute. No songs from The Dreaming have ever been sung live.
So there was a rumor, I don't remember how I heard it, that apparently she considered doing Sat in Your Lap Before the Dawn. I would have died! Oh my god.
I've heard that rumor too.
So the reason I bring that up is because, again, those songs seem unperformable. And Breathing to me, if I hear it, seems unperformed. Like, it seems like something that would not be possible to perform live. But, and then I hear the live version, I think, if she was able to do that, maybe she could have somehow done, like, a piano-based Suspended in Gaffa. I don't, you know, I,
oh, yeah.
Well, that one I think is because it also starts out piano, whereas some of the other ones don't have any piano at all. I think maybe for this she was able to do it because it does have a piano bass, whereas The Dreaming, she was composing, she wasn't even composing the songs on the piano at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does make you wonder, like, oh, how could, what would a live version of Leave It Open have been like? I think I'll just like be sitting on the subway and like get, think about that and get really sad randomly. So if you ever see me, if you're a Seared Red, if you're in New York, Seared Redhead wearing Kate Bush Dreaming t-shirt, getting sad, look sad, I'm probably thinking, if that's me and I'm thinking of that.
Well, there's that live performance, and then there's, since this was a single, there was a music video.
There's also, speaking of live performance, one other thing that just came to mind is it is a double bind. It's like what you're just saying is it's a sad reminder of her not touring, and it's a great setting. We don't get to hear this. If she did tour, we wouldn't have the work of hers that we have, though.
That is true.
That's the thing. It's like the reason she, and she's been very transparent. She's like, the reason I don't tour, it's not like all these rumors about I'm a crazy hermit or whatever. It's because I'm obsessive about the production and worked 12 hours a day on it. So if she were to perform, if she were to take time out to perform live, she wouldn't have had the time for the production. So, the you know, it's like a trip. It's a double bind.
Yep. So let's see, since this was a single, that also means that there was a music video. Okay, so I'm with you. I don't really like it very much.
So, as anyone who's listening to this podcast more long term knows, I like her being as campy and as over the top as possible. Like, bring it on. You know, be as, like, make the straight men hate you as much as you possibly can. Do it. But in this case, I'm not really a fan of this video. I don't think, because I think that the video, I mean, so the video, if you've not seen it, she's, I mean, this is Kate Literal Bush here. This is the woman who shivers when she sings the words, "I'm so cold." So she is in a literal womb, like Bubble Boy, or whatever that was, you know, the so she's in a plastic womb with a fucking, sorry, with a freaking umbilical cord. Like, it has, she has an umbilical cord. It is that literal. Pretending to be a fetus in a womb. So to me, I know, as much as I normally love her being as over the top as possible, this song is so powerful and rich and deep, but I think that the campiness of the video and its literalism dilutes the song's power. So, like, if I were to have watched just the video, I wouldn't really be focusing on the song. And I feel similarly, actually, about the title track of The Dreaming. That, I mean, I love that video. That video I actually love, but more in a silly way, because I know the dance to it, and it's, like, the most white, it's the most holy, like, the whitest dancing of all time. And it's really funny. But with both of those songs, both songs are very dark and foreboding. And then you have these videos that are silly. And to me, it takes away from the power of the song. And, like, for example, a song like Hammer Horror, as I mentioned in that episode, I love that song and I love that video. That video is ridiculous. It is the silliest video ever. They're literally, it's so silly, but it works because the song is so campy. Like, yes, it's dramatic, but it's also campy and theatrical. Whereas this song isn't really campy. To me, this is more just overwhelmingly powerful in a, like, tidal wave of emotions kind of way. So I feel like the video of her actually being a literal fetus with an umbilical cord takes away from the song's power. And but her makeup looks really good in it.
Yeah, she does look great makeup wise. Oh yeah.
good makeup.
I think that's what it is. Like, I was trying to figure out why I don't like the video very much, and I think, and I really believe it's what you were saying, that it's just the literalness of it takes away from the power of the song.
Right. And it's hard to imagine, like, what else would she have done for a video, you know? But I just would have, I would have maybe had, I just would rather be like, nope. That's kind of why I like, I almost would just prefer there wasn't a music video for this song, even though it was a single, because there had to be. But I think that it just, it's so vivid that you don't even need a video. Like, I think part of the reason why I love a lot of the songs in the second half of The Dreaming so much is because none of them have videos. So I'm kind of able to just have them exist in my head.
In your own head.
My own visuals. Yeah. Oh, really, really, really interesting to me, though, about this video is that it was released in 1980, as was the video for David Bowie's Ashes to Ashes. And both videos have the exact same imagery of there's a moment where she's wading through the water, like during the give me something to breathe part, and Ashes to Ashes, he does that too. And there definitely wasn't, it wasn't like one of them saw the other's video. It's like, oh yeah, I'm going to do that too. So it just goes to me, she's very similar to Bowie in a lot of ways. I see her kind of as like, I feel like if she was not a woman, she would get more of the respect that Bowie gets in America. But it's, to me, it's really sad. I also, okay, like, let's get personal. I call her my mom, and he's, like, my spiritual dad. So I'm like, my parents are doing the same thing at the same time, you know? So it's just really a funny coincidence that her and David Bowie were both doing this, like, they had the exact same part in these iconic music videos. But it's interesting, with this, I do watch her videos constantly. Like, so when I go to the gym, I just watch music videos. Most of the time, I'm just rewatching the same Kate Bush ones over and over, but to be honest. So, but I just rarely watch this one. I just, it's funny, like, there's just, I just, whereas, like, I'll rewatch Hammer Horror, Running Up That Hill, like, I'll watch film over and over, and even the Dreaming, but this, I don't really watch it often. It's a little cringy for me, but I feel weird saying that because I'm always that person who fights, who's like, no, don't call her cringy for being campy. But to me, the campiness doesn't work for this song.
Yeah, I like the ending part with, like, the just the effects that they put on the video when at the part where she's wading through the water, which reminds me, that part reminds me of stories I read about the people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that they were running out into the water to try and put themselves out after the blast.
Jeez.
Yeah. Oof. I had read stories of that. It came from a story that I read in my French class. I can't remember what story it was. It was by Marguerite Duras. And it was,
she's good.
Yeah, and it was, I think it was just Hiroshima Mon Amour.
Oh, we were reading that in French class. Have you seen the movie?
We actually watched the movie after we reread the book in French class. And it's this story about these two, I think one of them survived Hiroshima and the other didn't. I can't quite remember because it's been a while.
Yeah, I love the movie. It's about a French woman and a Japanese man who meet in Hiroshima. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was for my, like, Asian studies through French class or France and Asia. It was one of these specialized classes I took, you know, being a French major. And the Japanese man recalls people running out into the water because they were on fire. And so that ending, when I would watch the video again before we were talking, it made me think of that part and me going, ooh, kind of getting the shivers a little bit.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have made that connection because she's wearing a space. Her and all people in the video, she's waiting with a group of people, including Patty, of course, some others.
Yeah.
but they're wearing spacesuits. So I'm like, I feel like the spacesuits are meant to kind of insulate them from the nuclear fallout. But like, you can't. But yeah, it doesn't really make any sense. Again, even though I'm not a fan of the video, I also ask myself, what would she, I mean, it's a single, so happy video, so what would she have done?
I can't think of anything else she would have done either. All right, so any last thoughts about breathing? We're kind of wrapping up the episode here.
I think I've said my piece, but yeah, I think if I have further thoughts, you'll be able to read them on my blog in a couple years' time.
And so what's the latest blog post on Dream of Organon that people can go to?
Well, at time of recording, the most recent posted entry is on 5 Phoenix demos called, and I'm loading the website because I can't remember what I've written. Pink of the Rare Flower, On Fire Inside a Snowball, So Soft, Nevertheless You'll Do, Stranded on the Moon Base, which I'm pretty sure is the only piece of Kate Bush criticism ever that uses the phrase horny on main. And next up is, the entry I'm working on right now is Violin, which will obviously cite this podcast, so you can... So, if you go to the site, you can find a link back to the podcast you're listening to right now.
And where can people find your blog?
I am at Kate Bush. I'm at katebushsongs.wordpress.com.
Awesome. I look forward to reading more of your entries about Kate Bush's songs.
Thanks. I'm always excited to hear your podcasts.
Indeed. And thank you so much. Speaking of podcasts, thank you so much for being on the episode today to talk about one of your favorite Kate Bush songs, Breathing.
It's been a blast. Thank you.
Indeed. I think we pretty much hit everything for Breathing.
Pretty much. I mean, yeah, this is top three. I mean, for me to say that something's a top three Kate Bush song for me is saying a lot, because her works are the holy text for me. So, yeah, I mean, I just think that this song really establishes her as one of the great artists of our time. I think even, as I said earlier, if she had never made another album after Never Forever, this song, even on its own, would still mark her as a truly wonderful artist. And I'm so glad that she did continue making music after this. I think she would have been considered like kind of like a one-off footnote type thing if she hadn't. But I think even just this album, and it's such a perfect ending to this album.
It really is.
I mean, yeah, you're just, where else would it have gone? You're just, I'm going to stick this, three songs in, you know? Like with her preceding two albums, and like she will on her next album, it ends and you're just sitting there like, oh man, I have a lot to absorb right now. But especially this one in Get Out of My House. Like, you really just like, wow, okay. I just got hit with a baseball bat and need to sit down. It's such a masterpiece in every way, production, vocal, structure, everything. Thank you, Kate Bush, for making this song. Thank you for existing.
If you have a favorite Kate Bush song or songs that you want to talk about for a future episode, or if you know something about this week's song that we didn't get to, Here's where you can contact me. You can contact me through my website, kbcast.linkmedia.com. That's link with an E. You can email me, kbcast@linkmedia.com. Again, that's link with an E. You can find me on Twitter, @StrangeKateCast. And you can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/KateBushPodcast. Join us in a few weeks for the first B-side episode of this season, where I will get to talk with Zoe from this episode all about the empty bull ring. See everybody then.
I can't believe, I just cannot believe that now St. Helens is Kate Bush's fault. That's,
I mean, Kate is God, so.
Yes, Kate Bush is
God. She goes and creates everything.
I mean, now that just makes running up with Hill even more narcissistic, and like she's promising to make a deal with God. I'm like, you're already God, dude. Stop it.
Oh my God, I love it, man. Mon Dieu.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.